1 minute or 10 seconds. Yes, we are all set. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the time is 2:04 p.m.
Good afternoon. My name is Owen Egan, and I am the chairman of the Freedom of Information Commission. This is the regular meeting of the commission, April 28, 2021. Before we begin, I will take a roll call in alphabetical order so that the record reflects participating today. When I say your name, please indicate that you are present. Mr. Chavez.
Here.
Mr. Einhorn. Present. Mr. Musashi.
Here.
Mr. Hankin.
Here.
Mr. Shaw.
Here.
Mr. Streeter.
Here.
Mr. Winkler.
Here.
And Chairman Owen Egan. Thank you. This meeting is open to the public and is being conducted telephonically due to the COVID-19 pandemic. It will be recorded in its entirety. For everyone participating in today's meeting, please remember to identify yourself first for the recording each time that you are called upon to speak. All participants are expected to conduct themselves in a respectful manner at all times, not interrupt the commission deliberation. If the commission believes any person's conduct is disruptive, that person placed on mute at the direction of the chairman. Further disruption may lead to that person's removal from the telephonic meeting. When the commission conducts a vote, it will be by roll call. I will conduct the roll. First item is consideration of the minutes of the commission's meeting, April 14, 2021. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, this is Commissioner Streeter. I move that the minutes of the commission's regular meeting of April 14th, 2021 be adopted.
Second.
Commissioner Winkler, I second that.
All in favor, conduct the roll. All in favor, Mr. Berry. Mr. Chavez?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, sorry to interrupt the executive director here. Mr. Chairman, before the commission votes on this, I did have a proposed amendment on this one just from the hearing officer. It is not really a substantive change. It just sort of fleshes out the conclusion that's in paragraph 11 about the dismissal. And I'd be happy to offer that on her behalf. I don't think it'll change your ability to vote on it pretty quickly. It's up at your pleasure.
I'll withdraw my motion, Commissioner Streeter.
I'll withdraw the second, Commissioner Winkler.
Yes, so in paragraph 11 of the report, in the last sentence, there would be an addition to the last sentence along the following lines. Since the complainant agreed to accept copies of the internal affairs files in response to the request described in paragraph 10 above, it is concluded that under the facts and circumstances of this case, the respondents did not violate the FOI Act with respect to such records.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Streeter. I'd like to make an amendment in paragraph 11 as recommended by the hearing officer through the executive director for the language of the fiscal.
Commissioner Winkler, I'll second that.
Is there discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner Stray, I just want to make sure that both the complainant and the respondent don't have any objections to the amendment.
I just have one question. I was wondering if, because the respondent was supposed to send my attorney a copy of the record, was that, did that happen?
Mr. Wright, they were sent, from my records, they were sent, February 16th.
So all of the copies were sent to my attorney, correct?
Correct. Attorney of first time, correct?
Okay. So if that's factual, I have no objection. Hearing none, I'll take a roll call.
Yes.
Mr. Winkler?
Yes.
And Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you. Next is docket number FIC 2019-0503, Tom Harris, selectman, town of Woodbury et al. Is there anyone here on that matter?
Yes, I'm Tom Harris. Good afternoon. Mark Davis ready.
Thank you. Is there anyone here from the town of Woodbury?
Yes, Attorney Thomas Kalin on behalf of the town of Woodbury.
Thank you, Attorney Kalin. Mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2019-0710, David Collins and the New London Day versus Associate Attorney General State, Associate Attorney General State of Connecticut, Office of the Attorney General, et al. Is there anyone here on that matter?
Yes, this is David Collins. I'm here.
You like that, Mark? Ready?
Yes, please.
Is there anyone here from the state of Connecticut?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Assistant Attorney General Philip Miller on behalf of the state.
I didn't get your last name, sir.
Philip Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R.
Thank you, Attorney Miller. All right, we'll mark that ready. All right, so we have two matters. We'll pick up the first, but before we do that, we will ask
sure. For everyone in attendance, as has been stated, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety, so you do not need to ask for a recording. And second, pursuant to our regulations, oral arguments 10 minutes per side, and I will keep track of that for the parties.
Choosing
things not to do to advance the case that I was working on in court. So if the billing records show no activity, it is my position for any given month, and that's not the case, I'm giving you a hypothetical, that I've chosen not to do work on that file. And again, this is in the context, at the risk of repeating myself for the third time, hotly contested litigation. I think there were over 100 docket entries in this file. We were under scheduling orders and practice book and statutory deadlines to accomplish them. And to be able to show the other side or third party what I'm choosing to do and not do in advancing and meeting those deadlines is strategy. Strategy, commonly defined, is what you decide to do to advance your case. And on my entries, there are entries that I'm working on motions, that I'm meeting with clients, that I'm preparing affidavits. The hearing officer's interpretation of that, as I conclude from his report and finding, is that none of that represents strategy. And I respectfully beg to differ. It would reveal to others that I'm actively working to meet a litigation deadline, or conversely, where there are no entries when there's pending litigation deadlines, is showing that I'm choosing not to. For example, a motion for summary judgment deadline. If others could see that I'm actively working on preparing a motion for summary judgment, which some of these entries show, that is strategy. It's revealing to others what I am doing and decided to do to advance my case. And again, the converse would also be true for any given deadline. So it's my argument today, and it was my argument before the hearing officer. While I acknowledge the legal principles that he stated, the principles apply in my case because it was pending litigation, and the description entries while the case is pending show to the world what I've decided to do and not do to advance the case, and that meets the definition of strategy. It also meets the definition of showing the nature of the activity, which is part of the attorney-client privilege, what I'm doing. It would appear to me, looking at the hearing officer's conclusion, that the entries such as working on an affidavit for summary judgment reveal no strategy. And I think he is applying the definition, term, and meaning too narrowly. And that is all the argument that I have for today. Thank you.
Yes. I would disagree with a lot of what Mr. Kalin has just said. One of the contentions that I made at the hearing was that I conceded that perhaps some of the description would reveal strategy, but certainly not all of the description. The date, the amount of hours, and the amount per line item would do nothing to reveal strategy, yet they were redacted. I originally requested costs and copies of invoices and documents from January 1st, 2016 through the 13th of June, 2019. I believe the earliest invoice that was redacted that I received was a copy from September 21st, 2016. I addressed that no earlier documents were provided, redacted or not, at our hearing. Early time period. I don't know if any of those records from that period were provided to Mr. Matua for his in camera for his review, or is that part of my request still not applied yet? Also, under item 26, paragraph 1, respondents, it's asked respondents to provide unredacted copies of the in camera records to the complainants free of charge. I want to be sure that this includes records complying with the initial FOI request to the town, which goes back to the beginning of January 2016. And let's see, I've also never been supplied with the total cost as item 1 in my FOI complaint or request asked for. And things were handed to me piecemeal, and I'm not even sure if the town knows whether or not they supplied everything. I agree with your decision. I do ask that you impose maximum fines and penalties found, citing Mr. Kalin's recommendations, withheld the requested documents during the period of litigation, which appeared to be their goal.
to not impose fines and penalties and grant them success in their endeavors. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Are there any questions that the commissioners have?
Mr. Chairman, this is Commissioner Chavez. I have a question for counsel. It sounds from your argument like you're relying on Section 10b for the pending litigation exemption rather than 210b10, which is the privilege. Is that right?
I'm relying on both of them.
Okay. So it sounded in your argument like you were focusing on the pending litigation. So that's why I'm asking the question. But I would be interested to know whether your contention is that the pending litigation exemption is broader than the privilege. I just want to make sure I'm understanding your argument and your focus on the pendency of the litigation and your comment that once the litigation concludes, you understand there may be a different requirement under the statute.
Yes, so I think to answer your question, I am relying on both T10B4 and T10B10. In some respects, one is broader, in some respects it's not, and let me explain. With the attorney-client privilege, the case law is such, as cited by the hearing officer, talks about if it reveals a strategy or nature act of activity. And the pending litigation talks about records pertaining to strategy. So I believe there's an argument, and I'm arguing, that as to strategy, it's actually it's broader in the definition for before pending litigation. But attorney-client is broader in the sense that documents that reveal strategy or the nature of the activity is what is protected. And so I've argued before and today that the billing records for the attorney-client reveal both strategy and or the nature of the activity. And as to strategy, it's actually broader under pending litigation because it's not, it doesn't say it has to reveal the strategy. It has to be records pertaining to the strategy. And again, it's my interpretation that my billing records reveal all of my activity on advancing pending litigation for the client, and therefore everything that I choose to do or not do is strategy that I've adopted and formulated for my client. I also looked at this from the perspective of if my client didn't ask for written bills but asked me to come in one day a month and explain what I did on Mr. Harris's file for the entire month, it is my view that that would clearly be attorney-client and pending litigation protected. Discussion and meeting that he would not for anyone else be able to sit in and listen to that. I also take position from 30 years of litigation experience that if Mr. Harris or his attorney had asked in the litigation to see these bills, even if there were claims in the case that made my billing relevant, he would not be able to see them without the redaction, at least not till post-judgment phase of the case. And so all of that combined with my reading of the statute and the relevant case law has supported my argument that until the litigation is over, the bills redacted should comply with the statute.
So the discovery rule wouldn't pertain here to our interpretation of the Freedom of Information Act, but Mr. Harris made a comment that, for example, the number of hours that were spent on this matter by you or your firm were redacted, and that certainly, in Mr. Harris's view, if I understood him correctly, would not pertain to strategy. Is that, what's your position on that?
My position is that it does. If I'm spending, if my adversary is spending 40 hours on a motion or 40 minutes, that reveals to me what that attorney thinks of that motion, how important it is to the case, and how much work they're putting into it. And if I knew 2 weeks before a motion was due that they were spending 4 hours versus 4 minutes, it would give me an insight into their thinking of the importance of that motion, which would be their strategy on handling the case.
And again, there's no dispute. When the request came in, originally we understood it that they wanted to see the total amount, and we had agreed to provide that total amount. And then Mr. Harris said that was unsatisfactory. He wanted to see the bills. And our position was, we'll give you all the bills redacted while the litigation is pending, and it would be unredacted after it was concluded, and that was unsatisfactory, and the complaint was filed.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do any of the other commissioners have any questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Streeter,
I have one question or thought.
Mr. Streeter, go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you. As one of the non-attorneys on this commission, I asked my fellow commissioners, the linchpin paragraph in this hearing officer's report is 24, where the hearing officer makes a point of defining, strategy. And it says, he says a careful plan or method in the art of devising or employing plans or strategies towards a goal. And my question of the attorneys is, what is the legal definition of art? When I just look up what art is almost like in the eyes of the beholder. It seems everything that counsel has suggested is the art of strategy and negotiation. So, I know the hearing officer's not here to explain this, so I guess I'm leaning on my fellow commissioners to explain to me how this art is defined. If this is the main paragraph, as you can see, the rest of the paragraph hinge on this. Definition. Otherwise, I won't actually support this hearing officer unless I see the records in camera. So I guess I'd have to wait. Does anybody have an answer for me?
I mean, this is Commissioner Hankins. I don't see how the length of time really delves into someone's strategy or what they think of the case. I mean, it depends, really. A novice attorney could take a long time doing it, whereas an experienced attorney could take a relatively short time. I just don't see how filling, the number of hours in and of itself really is a linchpin for strategy. I just don't see it.
That didn't answer my question.
Well, no, I guess that's why I'm an attorney. The respondent's attorney said, well, if I went to the place and we had went to the client and we discussed it, they could have that. Well, no, they couldn't, because there wouldn't be a document created from that. So I don't see that either. Commissioner Sugar, I'm trying to chip away at some of the arguments. I just, the main thrust of it, these are billing records, and there is a lot of case law already involved, and I don't think that anything that's said, it's a novel argument. I like it, but the courts have already ruled that the bills in and of themselves are not exact, and there's not much art
maybe kind of a middle ground here. Some parts of these bills should be exempt and some not, but I'm not clear from the hearing officer's report or what was ordered, and the executive director Murphy, I don't know if you could speak to that in Attorney Perpetua's absence.
Thanks, Commissioner. I have not personally reviewed the records. I'm looking at the file right now, and there appear to be 30 pages at issue. And, you know, I'd be happy to take a look at them if you wanted to send it back, and I could give you, you know, a little better sense of what's in there. I think the difficulty here is the wholesale approach taken by Respondent's counsel, and in turn, the hearing officer appears to have taken a wholesale approach in the other direction. I would, you know, definitely rely on his expertise, but in his absence, again, I'd be happy to take a look and come back to you, or if individual commissioners wanted to review it, I could make them available to you, you know, prior to our next meeting or something like that. I do think that the Respondent's approach is really faulty and really doesn't address the case law on this topic. In the attorney-client privilege area, the case is cited by the hearing officer, where the courts have said, you know, you've really got to pinpoint what it is that is privileged, and the same would be true in terms of strategy. We've got some good language in those cases about, you know, this wholesale approach doesn't work. You can't just provide the total number of hours or the total, you know, bill. So I guess that's what I have right now in response to your query, Commissioner.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the, as I said, I did throw it out there for the, again, Commissioner Streeter, again, that, you know, for what, you know, my fellow commissioners who have more of a legal background. My only legal background is my, whatever, 9, 10 years on the commission. So, but I, and with that, I defer to their experience. I know we've had several attorney-client privilege cases, including some that I've been a hearing officer on. So, you know, I just wanted, you know, I think I like the argument that was made by the respondent, but as you said, I'm not asking that it be, you know, remanded at this point. If any other commissioners wanted that, I would support that. But, you know, the explanations I've received are satisfactory. My questions that I've already posed.
Yeah, this is Commissioner Hancock. Not to, you know, drag that dead horse out of the barn and beat it some more, but I just don't see how.
Support this decision as it is.
Chairman Egan? Chairman Egan? Colleen Murphy here. Could we just refine that motion to say that it will be remanded to staff, since we do not have the hearing officer? He has retired. So it would be remanded to staff as opposed to the hearing officer. And then after you do that, I have one further remark, but I can wait till the end.
Do we need to withdraw and make a new motion, or what would you say, Colleen?
If Commissioner Chavez would just like to withdraw and perhaps refine it in that way, that would be great.
Sure. Thank you. This is Commissioner Chavez. I'll withdraw the motion to remand and clarify that I am moving for a remand of this matter to staff, given Attorney Perpetua's retirement.
So hang on a second. The motion has been withdrawn. Is the second withdrawn?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Chavez, could you repeat your motion now, please? I'm sorry.
Sure. This is Commissioner Chavez. I would move to remand this matter to staff, given Attorney Perpetua's retirement in the intervening time period.
Motion has been made and seconded. Is there a discussion?
This is Commissioner Fusashi. I am going to support that motion. And one aspect of the remand for me, or one of this whole consideration, and the emphasis that was put on that these are pending claims, I think it's very interesting. What is the length of pending claims? Here this has been going for 3 years. Could it theoretically be 10 years? So I think the consideration also needs to focus on the time period of the time is already long past from my perspective, at least my thinking. So I agree with the motion to look back on it and see if there's more specific. Look back on this hearing officer's decision and come back with new thinking, perhaps.
May I interject at this point, Mr. Chairman? Colleen, would it be possible to offer the respondents an opportunity to submit some sort of statement to the commission as to whether it would like to point us in the direction of specific areas in these bills that it feels particularly might fall under either of those exemptions, as opposed to the wholesale approach that has been taken so far? The respondents could continue to rely on that wholesale approach, or afford themselves of the opportunity to relook at it and refine their claim if they would like. And we could mark that as an exhibit, as an after-filed exhibit, if the respondent is so inclined. And if not, that's okay too.
This is Commissioner Chavez. I would leave that to the discretion of the staff if the matter is remanded.
Okay, very good.
Are we ready to vote? Those in favor of Commissioner Chavez's motion, please, I'm going to conduct a roll call. Please state yes or no. Commissioner Chavez?
Yes.
Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Kadesh?
Yes.
Mr. Hankin?
Yes.
Mr. Shaw?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
Mr. Winkler? Mr. Winkler? Mr. Winkler
yes.
There?
Yes.
Thank you. And then myself, Chairman Owen Egan, yes. So the motion to remand passes unanimously. Thank you. Council, and thank you, Mr. Lorenz. We'll move on. Next is docket number FIC 2019-0710, David Collins from the New London DA versus Associate Attorney General, State of Connecticut.
I think Victor might have gone to. I think Victor might have gone to.
Are you there, Mr.
Collins?
Yes, I am.
No.
Are you there?
He just said the whole thing.
Yes, I am.
The examples that the guy gave.
Thank you.
Sounded like they might.
Collins, would you like to begin?
Sure. So I have a number of issues
back to us.
With the proposed decision. And one of the
stories. I one from the Attorney General's office representing the Attorney General's office, another from the Attorney General's office representing the auditor. And I totally escaped me if they were claiming that they had not been ever asked. And that was my sense of the proceeding was that they were both responding to them to reasons. They were both giving reasons why they hadn't produced it. And yet, number 11 in the proposed decision says there was no evidence that, that it was ever requested. Anyway, so I'm puzzled by that. Maybe I'm mistaken. And then that was somehow clarified in the jury. But overall, I guess my primary concern here is this is a really important issue, and I hope the commission takes it very, very seriously, because really at the heart of this is whether or not whistleblower complaints are public. And I think that goes really so much to the heart of what the commission does and what its objectives should be. And as I understand the law, of course, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a journalist, and there's some, the law is cited here actually in the proposed decision, and it makes it very clear that the lawmakers did not make the whistleblower complaint exempt. They made the identity of the whistleblower exempt, and they made investigations of the whistleblower complaint exempt. But they specifically did not make the complaint itself. In fact, it makes it very clear, even in the citation from the law, that the auditors of the public accounts receive the complaint, report their findings and any recommendations to the Attorney General, and on receiving that report, the Attorney General makes an investigation. So I would certainly agree that if the law then goes on to examine the investigations, I would agree that any material related to that investigation is exempt the same way police investigations are exempt once the public complaint is made. But in this case, I think there's a real distinction between the investigation and the materials related to that and the actual complaint, which was made to the auditors and then passed on to the Attorney General, which presumably followed the law and did an investigation. So, as the decision goes on, it refers to prior decisions, and those decisions all specifically say, and cite the fact that investigations and whistleblower complaints are not public, and I accept that, but at the heart of it, there has to be a complaint. A complaint is brought from sent from the auditors to the Attorney General, and that complaint is not exempted in the law. And it's such an important thing. As a journalist, I can't emphasize how important it seems for the whole point of whistleblower complaints and reviews is that these things can come to the surface and people can understand what's being investigated. And I'm interested in this case because it involves scandals involving a quasi-public agency. And the only reason why some of these things have come forward, that they've taken these whistleblower complaints, is because of
auditors and the attorney general may not be able to figure out who the whistleblower is, that doesn't mean someone with knowledge of that entity or organization, if that complaint became public, even if you redacted the whistleblower's name, wouldn't be able to immediately identify who the whistleblower is based on the information in the complaint. So, Neil, that's something that we, at 30,000 feet removed from the situation, would know. So I think it's very consistent. By protecting the identity of the whistleblower, you also would protect any records related to the whistleblower investigation, including the complaint, because it seems like without that, I mean, it'd be very difficult, I think, to actually release the complaint anyway without identifying the whistleblower. I know that issue wasn't decided by the hearing officer, but it does reflect also on why the commission has interpreted 1210B13 to relate to the whistleblower investigation. So I would ask to confirm the
Could I address that, please?
Do any of the commissioners have any questions?
This is David Collins. Can I address those remarks?
Sure.
So, this the same argument was made during the hearing, and I have to say it's very convoluted. And actually, I don't believe there's any testimony in the hearing as to how the identity of this particular whistleblower would have been linked to the information in his or her complaint. It's really sort of a stretch to say, well, you know, you can't reveal the identity of the whistleblower, but just saying, you know, what he was talking about or she was talking about in the complaint, then you can narrow it down and make hypotheses about who it is or isn't. I mean, again, I would point out, you know, there was a whistleblower complaint that led to the impeachment in the federal government. We still don't know who that whistleblower was, despite enormous amount of public interest and reporting and scrutiny of that whistleblower complaint. And also, I would say that, you know, the law is the law, and the whistleblower, if he makes a complaint, or she is going to have to understand that maybe what they're complaining about, if it's going to be investigated and acted upon, that there might be some suspicion that that's where it came from. There'd be no proof. Theoretically, the law would be followed, and that whistleblower would not be identified. But if you come forward and bring forth information about corruption or problems or crime, it has to anticipate that somewhere along the line that comes to some conclusion, and someone does something about that corruption or that crime, then you may be identified as the person who, if there's some suspicion that it might be you, then they would be there anyway, whether the complaint was ever identified because the result of the complaint was clear. So by taking that argument to the logical next step, you'd say, well, we can't really do anything with these whistleblower complaints because if we were to move on them and act on them, then maybe we would identify the whistleblower. I mean, it's just a really convoluted, strange argument. But the law is so clear that it differentiates between the complaint and the investigation and the materials related to the investigation. And I would hope that the commission would look really, really closely at that because, hey, this is just the heart of what freedom of information and transparency in the state should be.
Mr. Chairman, this is Commissioner Chabe. I have two questions. The first is for Attorney Miller from the Attorney General's office. Attorney Miller, as I read the Attorney General's opinion from 2002 that's cited in paragraph 18 of the hearing officer's report, it relies on the fact or the likelihood that the complaint itself would become part of the investigation file. My question to you is, if for some reason in a particular case there were no investigation, which seems at least theoretically possible under the statute, what would your position be as to the exemption of the complaint itself? So if there is no investigation, there's just a complaint that doesn't proceed to an investigation.
Well, so first, I don't know what here, but if that was, I guess, normally when, now the way the whistleblower statute is written, my understanding is we only get referrals from the auditors after they've conducted some sort of preliminary investigation to determine whether or not they even need to send it to us. So I think always a company file itself, but still don't think you would disclose it. Clearly, I still rely also on the fact that you could identify the identity of a whistleblower up, but I think in that scenario, we still probably not disclose the complaint itself, but again, that is not the situation we had before.
Yeah, understood. And then my next question is Attorney McGee here? Because I am wondering about the status of the Public Auditor's Office, which it was found in paragraph 9, there was no evidence that that Auditor's Office had received the complaint, and as the complainant pointed out, that he wasn't aware that that was being contested. So I'd just like to know more about that. Hi,
sure.
Attorney McGee.
Hi, how are you? Danielle McGee, I was the hearing officer, just for the record. That issue, I did raise that at the hearing, just to refresh Mr. Collins' recollection. I had asked him, and I had asked Attorney Miller, who the person who was the recipient of the request was and which agency she was with, and Mr. Collins made his request to a woman who works in the Attorney General's office, and the response acknowledging receipt of that request was by the Attorney General's office. Now, there was an attorney who was called to testify from the auditors about the specifics of the whistleblower complaints being made and the investigation that had proceeded from those that complaint, where there were actually multiple complaints in this case. But I didn't have any evidence from Mr. Collins to support that he had indeed made the request to the auditors, and so because I didn't have that evidence, I couldn't find that there was any denial, so I dismissed it as against the auditors, if that clarifies. And make one more point to Commissioner Chavez's question to Attorney Miller. I think in this particular case, the evidence that was presented by the respondents was not only that these complaints were made, and they were made orally, and there were subsequent meetings that were had, and there were some emails, but that information, which formed the basis of the complaint, was utilized as part of the ongoing investigation. And I found that testimony very compelling, and that's why I think in this particular case, the complaints certainly fall within the records of the investigation category under the exemption. It's not just that they were a complaint initiating, but they were, I had testimony that they were referred to, they were reviewed, they were, in our own precedent in the Virginia Brown case, prepared and received by the auditors and utilized as part of the ongoing investigation. And based on that very credible testimony from the two attorneys who were called to testify, I'm fairly certain that I reached the right conclusions on this case.
Could I comment on this?
Hold on a second. Do any of the other commissioners have any questions? Okay, yes, sir, you can comment.
Sir, if I heard that last argument correctly, I think what is being suggested is that by taking the complaint, putting it in a file, and then using that as the basis of the investigation, then the materials that go into that file are part of the investigation, and therefore exempt, that the original part of the file, the original complaint, then also becomes exempt. It's almost like it gets contaminated because it gets put in the same folder, the same file. And in fact, the law says that the auditors are supposed to review the matter and bring their findings and recommendations to the Attorney General, and then on getting that report, the report is referred to the law, the Attorney General investigates. So I totally understand that the investigation, but to say that the report becomes part of the investigation seems to fly in the face of the law, which separates them very clearly. And also, I'm sorry, in regards to Attorney McGee's comments about the auditors, I'm not sure I followed it, but in all of my routine, and I have to go back, I haven't honestly checked this, but usually when I file a complaint with the commission, it's because I filed a request and it hasn't been responded to. And I'm sure that usually when I file the complaint with the commission, I include those requests. I wouldn't have included the auditors if I hadn't requested the documents. And nowhere they responded in the hearing fully through their lawyer from the Attorney General's office to the issues and the fact of why they didn't respond and why they didn't give the material. So to now be sort of under the impression that they would never ask is completely news to me.
Mr. Chairman, this is Commissioner Chavez. I do have another question, which is, I don't
whether this decision is unique to the particular facts of the methodology of the way the complaint was made, or we should read it more broadly. And if it is, if I understood you correctly, that there's something unique about how the complaint was made, or could you clarify that and clarify whether you intend this decision to be more narrow or broadly read?
The way in which I've written this is based on the facts and circumstances of this particular case and the evidence that was presented. So the respondents had called two attorneys, one from the Attorney General's office and one from the auditors, who were involved in the different phases of the investigation as it proceeded through the two offices. And if I recall correctly, the testimony in this case was there were multiple complaints. Some came in by email. I believe another came in orally. And that at least for the oral complaints, there were subsequent meetings where notes were taken with the auditors that were investigating and the whistleblowers, and that that material formed the basis of the complaint, but that that material was also subsequently used as part of the investigation. There was testimony that was referred back to, it was considered, it wasn't just a standalone whistleblower complaint form that sat in a separate file. So in this particular case, I found that the records at issue constituted the records of the investigation that are permissibly exempt under 1-210B13. And to just get back to another point that it just reminded me of from Commissioner Chavez about the analysis of whether the documents or records could be disclosed with the whistleblower's identity redacted. There was a lot of testimony about that issue as well, and in testimony reflected that even if a name may be redacted, that because of the size of this particular agency, the information that was communicated as part of the whistleblower complaint, that you could not redact a particular person's name and still protect their identity. So I didn't feel I needed to get to that issue, but I did want to give that clarification that that testimony was presented.
I don't know how other commissioners feel. I would feel better if there was more than, I would feel a little better if there was more that hung on the specificity of this case, like you just explained it. I'm not sure I got all that out of the report. This is a more general and broad conclusion.
That issue briefly. You know, I've been covering this agency for a long time now and all of the unfolding scandals, and I can tell you that despite, and I know some elements of the white whistleblower complaint that have come forward, and I can assure you that I have no idea who the whistleblower is. And it's just a fairly small agency, and, you know, I know a lot about it. I know the people. I know the issues. And it's not enough for me to know. And that was sort of the testimony that I heard that day at the hearing, was that no one could point to, and these were people specifically involved with it, and I asked very clearly what it was that could make that, how directly they could make that link to this individual, and I didn't hear testimony to that effect. Thank you.
Are there any further comments from the commissioners?
This is Attorney Miller. I'm sorry, could I respond
to what it was? Are there any further comments from the commissioners? Okay. Attorney Miller, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to talk about the specificity of the concern. I think I would say that, Attorney McKee said, of course, is correct. We did all have a lot of testimony about how the complaint is used in this situation, so I don't disagree with that, she said. I guess I would just point out, though, I think, I think it should be more broad, because in any case, it's sort of like when you get a complaint to the attorney on the panel in a similar criminal case, the complaint
if I go to make a complaint to the police department, that's a public record. I've reported a crime, and it's investigated. The investigation is not public. The materials related to that investigation are not public. But arrest is public, and the complaint is public. And I think this is a perfect parallel. And they're trying to draw the distinction and hide the whistleblower complaint because they're saying the complaint is part and parcel of the investigation. And I think if you look at the parallel in law enforcement, it's exactly the opposite. The complaint, the arrest,
I didn't get Commissioner Shaw's vote.
Commissioner Shaw?
I'm in favor.
In favor.
You're not in favor?
He was in favor.
It,
you are or not?
Yes, in favor.
I don't think that's what he's saying. Mr. Shaw, are you in favor?
No.
Okay, thank you. So Commissioner Streeter is yes, Commissioner Einhorn is yes, and then everyone else, I think, is no.
Okay, so that would
so
be...
I think it fails. The question is, do we remand this back? Do we entertain a motion to remand this back?
Yes, I believe so. Remand it to the hearing officer.
Okay. Mr. Chavez, would you like to make that motion?
Yes, I would move that we remand this matter to Attorney McGee as hearing officer for further proceedings.
Commissioner Einhorn seconded that.
Yes.
Is there discussion on this motion?
Well, it sounds like it's Commissioner Streeter, it sounds like if it failed, it would automatically do that. I don't think we have to do a vote to do this. If that's what I'm saying. I mean, typically, if a motion or a fails, it's therefore dead, but we must have something about rules that if a hearing officer's report fails, it's remanded. I guess I wouldn't be in favor of it because it's already failed.
Attorney Murphy?
We don't have anything explicitly in our rules that says that. As a practical matter, that is likely what would happen. I wouldn't mind a motion to remand, though.
Okay. So the motion
is seconded. Commissioner, you might want to modify the wording of her notes. Said, I think, remand for further proceedings. I would like to take off the word proceedings. That might just remand, period. If she's open to that.
Sure. My intention was that my motion was to send the matter back to the hearing officer for further action on the matter, consistent with what has occurred here today.
That would be perfect. Thank you for clarifying.
So may I withdraw my prior motion and substitute it with a motion for remand to the hearing officer for
remanded to hearing Officer McGee for further action consistent with the discussion here at the meeting today.
Thank you.
Commissioner,
I want to second. Motion has been made and seconded. Is there a discussion on the motion to remand? Hearing none, I'm going to take a roll call vote of those in favor of the remand. Mr. Chavez.
Yes.
Commissioner Einhorn.
Yes.
Mr. Kizashi.
Yes.
Mr. Hankins.
Yes.
Mr. Shaw.
Yes.
Mr. Streeter.
I'm not in favor.
Mr. Winkler.
Yes.
And myself, Chairman Owen Egan, yes. So the motion passed. All right. Thank you, Mr. Collins. Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. I just think we have one matter to report very briefly on, and that involves Mr. Godbout's petition for certification to the Supreme Court on his loss. And I'll turn it over to Attorney Reed to just tell you about that in a few sentences, right?
Thank you, Attorney Matthew Reed. This is the Godbout case. This originated back in 2018. This is a leave not to schedule. He then argued the leave not to schedule before the Superior Court. Superior Court granted our motion for summary judgment and essentially dismissed the case. He then appealed that to the Appellate Court. And on March 2nd of this year, the Appellate Court affirmed the dismissal that was granted by the Superior Court. He then petitioned for cert to the Supreme Court. And on April 20th of this year, the Supreme Court denied certification along with his motion to disqualify all of the justices of the Supreme Court. So that should bring that matter to an end effective April 20th this year. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Attorney Reed. The next item will be Executive Director's Report and the status of our operations during COVID-19. And as we've, you know, been keeping you apprised, the video hearings are rolling out. We are looking ahead to our hearing and meeting schedule after the move, and Mary and I have begun discussions about stepping up our hearing schedule as soon as we are settled after the move, you know, increasing the number of hearings we do, since we do have a backlog of cases larger than normal as we have, you know, as we're coming out of the pandemic. So we'll really be looking to that. And you might expect, too, that our future commission meetings will eventually have several more cases on them, as, you know, they used to have around a dozen or, you know, maybe up to about 14 or so. And we've had fewer than that, certainly, these past several months. So we'll be looking to increase that. We may even need to have a special meeting. We'll see down the road, but we'll keep you posted on that. And, of course, we're also looking at, you know, to whether and when to potentially resume in-person hearings. And I would say that's not immediate, but it's something that we will look to do, I hope, before, you know, this year is out. And then the next item on, you know, relocation of our offices. The date for our move is still May 28th, and we're fast and furious getting packed up for that with a lot of help from everyone on our staff, to whom I'm very grateful that we're moving this along. Our new office address is going to be 165 Capitol Avenue, Suite 1100. And we're going to be, you know, getting the word out about that official change of address. We'll be putting it up on our website and including it in our notices and eventually changing our regulations as well, which set forth our business address. And That'll be happening very soon. We're going to roll that information out and try to get it as well known as possible. And just a reminder that we won't have our meeting on May 26th. We will have our next meeting before we move, but not the one on the 26th of May. Under staff reports, I don't have anything major to report. We're still working on our paperwork to refill the position left vacant by Victor Perpetua. Then, let's see, under our legislative report, Attorney Perlman has taken a rare few days away, but in her stead, Attorney McGee has offered, she's got the lucky job of filling in a little bit for Paula. So I think Danielle just wanted to report on a few of the bills, and things are rapidly happening over at the legislature now. Danielle, you still there? You are.
Yeah, so I'm here. I turned my camera on. I just have a brief update. Attorney Perlman asked me to report on a couple of bills where there's been some movement recently. The first is House Bill 5011, and that's an act concerning the copying of public records under FOIA. That's the bill we talked about previously. It's to reduce the fee for copying public records and also to update the definition of a handheld scanner. And the status on that one is it's been referred from the House to the Planning and Development Committee. So we'll continue to monitor it there. And Attorney Perlman reminded me that in prior years it died in that committee, but this year one of the proponents of the bill is on that committee. So I think we're more hopeful that we might see some momentum there this session. The second one is Senate Bill 881. That's an act concerning workforce development. That's one of the governor's bills, and we talked, Attorney Perlman talked a little bit about that one as well last time. Where we are with that, there's a few provisions that implicate access to public records, having to do with employer and employee information and student college admission application and financial aid application information. And so we're working with some staff in the governor's office to refine some language there to just, you know, force that balance between access and protecting personally identifiable information. So that's sort of in progress. We're still working on language. And then the third bill she wanted me to update everyone on is House Bill 6193, and that's an act subjecting certain non-state entities that serve a governmental function to the Freedom of Information Act, and then certain officers would be subject to the Code of Ethics. Where we are with that one, I believe we've been working on language to fine-tune that so that it's more specifically geared towards entities that are intended to be covered by that bill and not be so broad. And I believe the latest is that we've turned language over to the lobbyist for CCFOI to connect with Representative Candelaria on that. So that's all I have. I don't know if Attorney Murphy has anything she wants to add.
Just, yeah, a quick supplement, because I think this is breaking news even for you, Danielle. Just before the meeting, I got some language from Planning and Development on that fees proposal. So it looks like it has some life, and that PND will likely vote it out of committee. I think whatever, I haven't really reviewed it yet, but whatever is coming out of there, I think it will be favorable to access and reduction of fees. Potentially both in terms of paper copies as well as dealing with the electronic copying by individuals using a handheld device. So I think that will be a positive step. And then on the 6193, the non-state entities one, the language that we worked on has been submitted to Representative Candelaria for his review, and it's a tricky one, and I think Commissioner Fusashi might have brought it up last meeting. It's a tricky one to try to define what we want to get at. And for now, that's all I'll say, but we're trying to make it specific as to when it would apply and to whom. But it is a tricky task of writing language that would get at this. So just know that we are working on it. Happy to share with you further, you know, the language if you're interested, but we're trying to pare that down a little bit. So I think that's all we have at this point, unless you have some questions for me or anyone else.
Commissioner Streeter, motion to adjourn.
Commissioner Einhorn, second.
I'll take a roll call vote. Commissioner Chabay?
Yes.
Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fusashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankin?
Yes.
Commissioner Shaw?
Winkler?
Mr. Winkler? Yes. Owen Egan, yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Winkler. And Owen Egan is yes. So we're adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Great job.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.